This is the Voice of Freedom.
This is my happening and it freaks me out.
Never before since Jamestown and Plymouth Rock has our American civilization been in such danger as now.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Jesus was black, Ronald Reagan was the devil, and the government is lying about 9/11.
The government, they the biggest monster. That's what we study. Governments.
Everybody's scared of the government, you know what I'm saying?
Politics is nothing but war without bloodshed, and war is nothing but politics with bloodshed.
Like 1984.
Does it look like stable thoughts go through my mind?
God damn America!
Having that dream where you made the white people riot, weren't you? How many times have I told you you better not even dream about telling white folks the truth?
We need to open our eyes. Our government doesn't give a shit.
This is about your life and mine. We're losing our freedom. And this isn't something that's going on far away. This isn't something that's happening places we can't do anything about it. It's happening right here.
And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brother.
The enemy should be in no doubt that we are his nemesis and we are bringing about his rightful destruction.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
We're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House!
Thank you for your time and good night.
What is the haps, Hap Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your higgity higgity host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. And some exciting news for some of you. The shirts came today, and so the shirts were mailed today. So those are in the mail. Those of you who ordered them should have tracking numbers. They should, in most cases, be to you by the end of the week, except those of you who live in other countries. I have absolutely no fucking clue when you're getting your stuff, but you also have tracking numbers. And a bit about that. Well, first and foremost, shout out to Luke Hamburski for getting those shirts printed after the snafu that I had with my original printer. Anybody who needs screen printing done, hit up Luke. He does great work. But a bit about the mail service. So I don't know if it's life imitating art. I don't know if I've always been this way. Yeah, I do. I've always been this way. But maybe more so as I got older, and some of that might be because so many people told me I was gonna mellow out as I got older, and perhaps even become more conservative as time goes on. Anyway, as I've gotten older, I've found that my I think some people call it obstinate defiance disorder? Is that what they call it? Maybe it's just thinking everybody's wrong all the time. I really don't know. We don't have to clinicalize everything. It manifests itself in such a way with like laws and things of that nature where I'm basically a sovereign citizen who doesn't believe in Black's Law Dictionary. You know, whatever the radical Black militant left interpretation of the sovereign citizen is. I'm basically one of those. That is to say, I don't like anyone telling me what to do about anything ever. And if I do it, it's usually because I've convinced myself that I came up with it first, or no, yeah, that's a good idea. But I don't handle direction well. So I don't do well in government offices to start out with. And I had to go to a post office twice today. And I learned in my trip to the post office, which I have to say, after learning that post agent workers are basically just mail pigs, I've been skeptical to begin with. But I found out today, in mailing international packages, that internationally mailed clothing has to have a gender. I don't know if you were aware of that, that you can't just mail a shirt. A shirt has to be for a man or a woman. You can't just mail a shirt. So I'm filling out the customs paperwork to mail shirts, and the post office worker says, is it a men's shirt or a woman's shirt? And I said, it's unisex. And he kind of sucked his teeth at me, and he said, so, is it for a man or a woman? And I said, it's for a non-binary person. Like, now what? And he goes, well, I don't even know what to put then. And I said, that's why it's a stupid fucking question. And what ensued, listeners, was what I was alluding to earlier, is that the older I get, I don't find that I'm mellowing out. I'm turning into the Black Dale Gribble. Because I found myself in a post office yelling at a postal worker about how stupid the fucking federal government is. That you need to know, for some purpose related to the illusion of national security, the genitalia of the person I'm sending a shirt to. Who does that help? In what way does this win us the war on terror, sir? This is fucking ridiculous. Explain this to me. No. You explain this to me now. How does you knowing the gender of clothing prevent terrorism? If you can tell me that, I'll write something on this paper. If not, you and Uncle Sam can go fuck yourselves, because this is ridiculous. And it spiraled both in person and in my mind, because once the confrontation itself is over, it becomes a living thing inside my head for hours after the fact, as I go over whether or not I was inappropriately confrontational with a stranger, whether I said anything that I probably should have regretted in the event that someone was recording me, things of that nature. And I have had this thought, and it started after 9/11, honestly, because that's really when national security became kind of a conversation we just needed to fucking have about everything we do, and why there was suddenly a justification for the government to have an opinion about everything we do and a say in everything we do, because it made you feel safer. And I don't know if it's because I'm Black or because I've been in intermittent periods in my life considered to be a criminal, or because I've been to prison, or because I fucking think, but all of the things that have traditionally been for the purposes of making people feel safer or national security have just put me more on edge. Armed guards don't make me feel safer. Metal detectors make me worry that I have something on myself that I shouldn't. I'm not one of those people who the Patriot Act made feel safer. I'm one of those people who started second, third, and fourth guessing every goddamn email that I sent because I was afraid that I'd use the expression "da bomb" inappropriately all of a sudden. So I can't relate. Is what I'm trying to say. And I got to thinking about, I traveled quite a bit immediately following 9/11. I actually traveled internationally like 5 or 6 months after the fact. I went to Europe for like 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks. And I can remember 9/11 is, I think I've mentioned on the show previously, sort of like a benchmark point in my life as like a politically active person, because it was kind of like where a switch flipped in my mind as far as the federal government, political awareness, those kinds of things, as well as activism to a point, although that didn't kick off as much until a few years later. I became politically aware, I think, after 9/11 would be fair to say. That's also kind of when I dropped out of mainstream culture entirely. And flying and dealing with airport security in the wake of 9/11 had a bit to do with that as well, I think, because you don't fully grasp the ineptitude and redundancy of the concept of federally mandated security unless you flew right after 9/11. Hey, you're going somewhere? All right, we're going to need you to come 4.5 hours early. The first thing we're going to do is unpack all of your bags. Then we're going to give you your shit back and then have you repack your bags because you're going to need to carry that shit 150 yards over there where we will then unpack it again and then go through it with a wand. And then we're going to send you outside where you're going to go through a metal detector. And then you're going to go down some stairs where we're going to send all of your shit through an X-ray machine and have you go through another metal detector. And then we're going to go through your bags again. And then we're going to have you go through another metal detector at the gate where you will be wanded and patted down before you get on the plane. Do you feel safer? Or do you feel inconvenienced and irritated because you can't have a cigarette for the next 13 hours? I know how I felt. But the only thing that was more ridiculous than American international airport security was German international airport security, because the airport in Munich had armed guards with dogs carrying automatic rifles walking around the airport. There were 14 checkpoints, and at the checkpoint at the gate where you went to get on the plane, they searched the pilot and the crew. I'm going to repeat that. They searched the pilot and the crew of the plane to make sure that the guy flying the plane wasn't going to use a gun to hijack the plane. Look, I get that fear does weird things to people. I think that fear does weird things to white people because you don't grow up being afraid like the rest of us do, because we're all afraid of you. But it's insane to think that this fixes or prevents anything. And do you know why that is? As a person who's studied and fairly been immersed in conspiracy culture since my preteens, these ideas that there are elaborate, detailed plans to accomplish goals are 99% of the time not the case, unless it's the federal government doing it. Then there are elaborate, dumb, fuck-off plans for everything. But when it's the average person doing something, like shooting up an airport, for example, it's not an elaborate plan. Someone snaps, gets a rifle, and walks into an airport. You don't need 7 checkpoints to make sure that I didn't, over the course of a month, dispense pieces to build a rifle throughout the airport like I'm in a fucking video game, so that by the time I get to the gate, oh shit, I have an M16. That's never happened, and it's never going to happen unless the CIA does it, quite frankly. Your biggest concerns are people who just do things because you can't plan for them. You know how most presidents have been shot? Someone walked up to the president and shot him. It wasn't an elaborate clandestine plan where a group of Russians met in an underground bunker and then programmed a person to... Well, this actually ties into what we're talking about today, so fair enough, Mox. Programmed some cat like the Winter Soldier to, when he hears benchmark Dolly Parton 5 Red Boat, he switches on and goes and does a thing. No, it's some person who really fucking hated Gerald Ford. Squeaky Frome walked up and shot Gerald Ford. That's how that happens, and you don't plan for that. It's whatever happens in the moment. That's why your tax dollars go to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in presidential security, so that there's people within arm's reach of that motherfucker all the time, so nobody can just snap and try to shoot the president, because nobody would want that to happen, would they? But anyway, you don't need all of this redundant security bullshit. All it does is inconvenience everybody and give rubes the illusion of safety, which is all that it's for, really. So that's a very long tale on a kite to tell you I hate the fucking post office. And also that apparently clothing has to have gender if you want to mail it internationally. So stick that in your back fucking pocket and do with it what you will. Anyway, on today's episode of the show, no, this isn't a Mock Speaks. I just took 15 minutes to bitch about the government for no apparent reason whatsoever, as if that isn't just what I'm going to do with a script for the next hour. Today, we're going to extend on our topic from Monday's episode of the show and talk a bit more about mind control, brainwashing, a bit about cult psychology. We are going to talk a bit about MK Ultra because I weighed the pros and the cons and I thought to myself, there's probably things that I could have covered better than I did, you know, a year ago whenever I was doing it as an addendum to Charles Manson. And perhaps there's people who haven't heard that episode of the show. I am forever discouraging people from listening to the first season of the show. Maybe some people listened. So we're going to talk a bit about MK Ultra today. And we're going to have a look at how the brain can be manipulated to make you shoot the president. Not really. But kind of. But not really. Anyway, here we go. Like we started to talk about on Monday, Jonestown really brought the idea of brainwashing and then deprogramming into the mainstream. But that idea, like we discussed, traces to CIA propagandist Ed Hunter in 1950, some 20 years earlier. It exploded 9 years later with Richard Condon's novel, The Manchurian Candidate, which introduced the general public to the idea that communists could brainwash any regular old American Joe into assassinating the president, perhaps. In The Manchurian Candidate, Major Bennett Marco, Sergeant Raymond Shaw, and the rest of their infantry platoon are captured by an elite Soviet commando unit during the Korean War in 1952. They're then taken to Manchuria and brainwashed into believing that Shaw saved their lives in combat, for which he's subsequently awarded the Medal of Honor. Years later, Marco, back at the United States working as an intelligence officer, begins to have recurring nightmares in which the platoon members are surrounded by a group of little old ladies who had been part of their brainwashing exercises. One of the ladies tells Sergeant Shaw to murder two of his platoon comrades. The backdrop with the old ladies changes back and forth between them and Chinese or Soviet intelligence officers. When Marco learns that another of the platoon soldiers had been having the exact same nightmare, he starts trying to figure out what's going on. The major looks up Sergeant Raymond Shaw and discovers that Shaw's new manservant is someone that he recognizes from Korea. Marco and the manservant start having a fight, and they're both bloodied significantly. Marco is arrested, and when Shaw sees that it's his old major, they rekindle their friendship. They both find love interests. For Marco, it's a woman named Rose Cheney, whom he meets on a train. And Raymond meets Jocelyn Jordan, the daughter of Senator Thomas Jordan, a neighbor of his. Senator Jordan and Shaw's mother don't like each other, but Raymond continues to see Jocelyn anyway. It's then revealed that the communists have been using Shaw as a sleeper agent, who, activated by a post-hypnotic trigger, immediately forgets the assignments he carries out and therefore can never betray the operation, either purposely or inadvertently. In Shaw's case, the suggestion that he play solitaire is the trigger. Seeing the Queen of Diamonds playing card transforms him into an assassin who will kill anyone at whom he's directed. His KGB handler is his mother, Eleanor, married to a McCarthy-esque senator named Johnny Islin. Eleanor has convinced the communist powers to help install her husband as president and allow them to control the American government through him. By observing Shaw, Marco discovers the trigger shortly before the National Convention of Islam's political party, and he uses the Queen of Diamonds card to draw out Eleanor's plan. After she obtains the vice presidential nomination, Shaw is supposed to shoot Islam so that she can take over as president. Sounds like an Alex Jones plot. Blaming the killing on the communists will enable Islam to assume dictatorial power. Marco reprograms Shaw, although it's unclear until the final pages of the book whether this actually worked or not. At the convention, Shaw instead shoots and kills his mother and Senator Islam. Marco is the first person to reach Shaw's sniper nest, getting there just before Shaw turns the gun on himself and commits suicide. It's a troubling book, and neither of the films really spend any time drawing out the fact that the main character is very clearly fucking his mother through a good bit of the book while they travel around the world and he kills politicians for her. But this concept of communist brainwashing was used over and over and over again in popular culture and through CIA operations like Jonestown to convince the general public that communists could reach inside your mind and trick you into becoming a communist. The idea of sleeper agents was huge in the Cold War. The idea of sleeper agents who didn't know that they'd been programmed has played a part in quite a few JFK assassination conspiracies, in fact. And we've talked in the past about ideas being created as propaganda and sort of being made manifest by a will of creation. There's been a lot made of MKUltra, and we'll get a bit into that later, but a fairly famous case that involved brainwashing was alluded to on Monday in the Patty Hearst kidnapping. Patty is the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst, and she was kidnapped in 1974 by the Symbionese Liberation Army, or the SLA. The SLA was a sort of vanguard left politically militant group of about 20 people that is considered by the FBI to be America's first left-wing domestic terrorist organization. They were only active for 2 years, from 1973 to 1975, and they were polarizing, to say the least. They murdered a black high school principal, and the group was almost entirely white, so radical support was slim. They also robbed banks and kidnapped, tortured, and raped a newspaper heiress, allegedly. So, mixed feelings as far as most people are concerned, I think. They styled themselves after the Tupamaros, Uruguayan guerrillas, who I mentioned on Monday kidnapped and murdered Jim Jones's original CIA handler. They also studied French revolutionary philosopher Régis Debray, a colleague of Che Guevara's. The group formed when its leader and the only black member, Don DeFreeze, escaped from prison. DeFreeze allegedly just walked the fuck away from work duty and hopped the fence. And then he made contacts with left radical group Venceramos, who helped hide him and whose members would go on to join his group, the SLA. Not surprisingly, it's widely believed that DeFreeze was an informant and a plant of the FBI. Symbionese is a derivation of symbiosis. It's not a place. It's a reference to intersectional liberation, anti-racism, anti-capitalism, feminism, anti-fascism, sort of a left-wing united front. The group's logo was the Hydra, meant to represent the multi-headed approach that they took. You can't make this shit up. The group killed, like I said, a black school superintendent named Marcus Foster on November 6th, 1973, with hollow-tipped bullets that had been stuffed with cyanide. Foster had been the first black public school superintendent ever. But according to the SLA, he was a fascist. Or the SLA was an FBI front group. Whatever. According to the SLA, they murdered America's first black high school principal in an attempt to gain support from the black community and expand their black membership. In actuality, black critics of the SLA described them as, quote, uniquely mediocre and stunningly off base, end quote. Two members of the group, Joseph Ramiro and Russ Little, were later arrested and charged with Foster's murder in January of 1974. They were later convicted and sentenced to life, although Little would be acquitted on retrial in 1981. Ramiro remains incarcerated and all parole requests have been subsequently rejected to this day, however. Patty Hearst was kidnapped in retaliation for the incarcerations of Russ Little and Joseph Ramiro. It's been alleged that the FBI had prior knowledge that the group was going to act, and that Hearst lived close to their base of operations, but again, I'm pretty sure the SLA was run by the FBI, so why would they care? The Hearst family's anti-communism was and is legendary, just like their print empire. So this group of 20 wannabe guerrillas was suddenly the most well-known political subversive group in the country. They issued an ultimatum that they wanted to exchange Hearst for Little and Ramiro, which was obviously refused by law enforcement. They also demanded $400 million in food distribution from the Hearst family, equivalent to $70 per person for every impoverished individual in the state of California. This was actually agreed to, until violence broke out at one of the food distribution centers when the size of the crowd far exceeded expectations and frightened workers injured several people throwing boxes of food into the crowd. Hearst's kidnapping reinforced ideas about brainwashing and Stockholm syndrome when she was recorded saying that she had joined the SLA and changed her name to Tania, and then later was filmed, aiding in a bank robbery, conveniently shouting, quote, "My name is Tania, up against the wall, motherfuckers," to a group of hostages while showing her face directly for the cameras, like people robbing banks do. A word about Stockholm syndrome, by the way. It's not real. It's never actually been proven because it isn't a definable condition. It's never been included in the DSM, and it's actually only formally recognized by the FBI. It was coined in 1973 when four hostages taken during a bank robbery defended their captors and refused to testify in court. Now, it's noteworthy that the police in this case showed little to no concern for the hostages' safety. The refusal to cooperate with law enforcement is actually one of the recognized characteristics of this made-up illness created by the FBI to explain why people refuse to cooperate with the FBI. The other characteristics are positive feelings towards your captor, seeing a captor's humanity, and having no previous relationship to your captor. It's sort of fascinating that viewing a criminal as a human being is a sign of a psychological disorder to the FBI. Stockholm syndrome is frequently associated with the other fake anti-communist propaganda of brainwashing, And in the Patty Hearst kidnapping, you had an FBI-run domestic terrorist group fake a kidnapping and weave a story about a Marxist-Leninist group brainwashing a rich girl into giving herself an ethnic name, dressing like one of the Black Panthers, and robbing banks with an automatic rifle. To give the public an example of brainwashing before Jim Jones and the People's Temple would give them a much bigger one a few short years later, of course. Hearst's own accounts of the event sound like anti-communist propaganda about being beaten and forced to read theory with a flashlight in a dark room until her thoughts gradually mirrored those of her captors. Before Hearst was extracted, rescued. Most of the SLA, including DeFreeze, were killed in a shootout with police. Which is good. You wouldn't want anyone telling the press what actually happened. Not that they'd report it if you did. Leo Ryan had been collecting signatures to petition for Hearst's release from prison when he left for Jonestown. And Jim Jones's friend, Rosalynn Carter's husband, the President of the United States, commuted her sentence and she was released in 1979, nearly a year before she would have been eligible for parole, at which point she married one of the police officers who was part of her security detail. She was then pardoned by Bill Clinton in 2001 and restored all of her civil rights. It may interest the listener to know that outside of the United States, brainwashing is considered pseudoscience, and cults are largely considered to be imaginary. Have we talked about Drapetomania before, by the way? I don't remember, so let's do it real quick. In 1851, Samuel Cartwright, allegedly a doctor, coined the term to explain the mental disorder of runaway slaves, because all of the accepted science of the time, particularly before the Nat Turner revolt, said that slaves liked and in fact preferred being slaves and were incapable of being happy otherwise. So when slaves kept, you know, running away and killing white families, a disorder of the mind was invented and blamed. The treatment, of course, for runaway slave syndrome was whipping and toe amputation, because that'll fix your brain. By the same token, brainwashing is an attempt to explain why anyone would want to be a communist. Something must have been done to the way you think, because normal people don't think like that. And I think an examination of most famous cults, especially in the 70s, yields covert CI operatives and FBI smear campaigns aimed at the Soviet Union and the Chinese. Except for the US's own attempts at mind control with MKUltra, which is where I think most cult leaders learned their craft in the first place. A major proponent of the idea of brainwashing, cult deprogramming, and the anti-cult movement was a woman named Margaret Singer. Singer worked extensively with the Cult Awareness Network and the American Family Foundation, and she co-authored the book Cults in Our Midst. The APA reviewed her work in 1983 and concluded that it lacked sufficient scientific rigor, but she'd served as an expert witness in court cases related to cults and brainwashing for nearly a decade prior to it being acknowledged that nobody had actually verified her work before. Singer looked at cults as groups that exercise undue social and psychological influence over individuals using coercive, persuasive techniques. She was hired by the US military in 1953, and she studied the American POWs, who were alleged to have been brainwashed by the Chinese in Korea to admit to war crimes that the U.S. definitely wasn't actually committing. So, she was a fixer with a degree. We talked about this with Project Blue Book and UFO activity, in that the military hires consultants to expertly certify its own desired conclusions. Prior to working as a military employee, she studied schizophrenia and child and family communication. But as part of the brainwashing is real campaign, Singer worked to prove psychological coercion, and in the wake of the Jonestown event, she tied the idea to cults, something she worked closely with the government and Christian advocacy groups to develop into an accepted cultural idea. Cults program and brainwash people into doing things against their will. Her professional diagnosis of the Hillside Strangler was, quote, "He may simply be evil," end quote. You know, a medical diagnosis. As evil. A thing that doctors diagnose. She later lost her status as an expert witness for testimony on brainwashing because it isn't real. Singer was an early champion of deprogramming, another fake thing that definitely does not work, but probably does traumatize people. Deprogramming was sort of invented by a man named Ted Patrick. Ted says he was... His life story is basically the lyrics to Jumping Jack Flash, and he claims that he got into deprogramming when a cult psychologically kidnapped his son, and that he learned the skills from, I'm not fucking with you right now, witches, warlocks, and faith healers that he met in New Orleans, which I'm sure isn't bullshit at all. Warlocks totally teach boys who were raised in brothels magic tricks to prevent mind control all the fucking time. Patrick helped found the Cult Awareness Network, and he spoke before Congress at the behest of Bob Dole. He also nearly killed a 35-year-old woman named Susan Wirth after her parents paid him $27,000 to fix her from being a leftist. Patrick handcuffed her to a bed and starved her for nearly 2 weeks. He's been charged with kidnapping and false imprisonment numerous times because he's kidnapped and held people hostage numerous times. Studies into deprogramming also show that it almost never works. After all, if you want to completely alienate your loved ones, pay a backwoods hillbilly in a van $30,000 to kidnap them and chain them to a bed for a month. The government, of course, never one to see human rights violations and not get in on the action, has attempted to pass legislation legalizing involuntary deprogramming in New York, Nebraska, and Kansas. It should also surprise no one that most deprogrammers split finder's fees with groups like the Cult Awareness Network. So, if this sounds a lot like conversion therapy mixed with human trafficking, you totally shouldn't worry. It's doctors and Christians and law enforcement working together. What the fuck is the worst that could possibly happen? Perhaps a network where parents pay church groups to kidnap their gay kids, a thing that actually did happen to Stephanie Reithmiller in 1981 when her parents hired deprogrammers to fix her lesbianism. She was subsequently held hostage and subjected to multiple days worth of corrective rape. In fact, most cases of deprogramming had nothing to do with cults at all. it was a conflation of leftism or communism or homosexuality with mental illness. Attempts to recontextualize leftism, feminism, black liberation, or queerness as mental disorders dates back to the 1800s. Further, if we're talking about hysteria, as we discussed in a previous episode when we talked about Wandering Womb, this allows the institutionalization of ideas that opposition to things like patriarchy, capitalism, or white supremacy is so abnormal as to suggest that something must be wrong with you if you disagree with them. It's the thought policing 1984 shit all over again. The idea that there is a correct way to feel about the state, capitalism, and who should be in charge and who you're supposed to fuck, reinforced by medical diagnoses and enough illusion of expertise to create the illusion of consensus and then the illusion of safety. We're safe when someone is keeping an eye on anyone who might trick us into thinking something that normal people aren't supposed to think. God forbid someone heps you to an idea and breaks you. You could end up in a cult, for fuck's sake. Cults, as we understand them, are a phenomenon of the last two centuries, really. The word itself dates back to the ancient Greeks in reference to religious devotional practices of the state faith of Rome, but these aren't really analogous to cult as we use it today, which is really just a Westernism for religious group I don't like most of the time. The idea of cults in the U.S. was largely proliferated by the Christian counter-cult movement of the 1940s. The foundations of the counter-cult movement are an evangelical fundamentalism and a belief that all Christian sects and denominations that are not based in fundamentalist biblical interpretation are heretical or are heretical cults, like Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Christian Scientists, Catholics, the Unification Church, Swedenborgianism, which we've discussed in the past. The first goal of the counter-cult movement was establishing what was fringe among Christians themselves. One of its most prominent figures, Walter Ralston Martin, wrote numerous books and hosted a radio program called Bible Answer Man that still airs with a new host, actually. And Martin and his contemporaries ousted all of these smaller, less conventionally accepted sects of the church that grew in popularity during the spiritualist boom of the 19th century. Martin and the counter-cult movement broadly defined cults as a perversion of religious beliefs, and this served as the basis for the anti-cult movement of the 1970s. Cults were just religions that your parents didn't like, unless they were CIA operatives aimed at discrediting the left or products of the MKUltra program. The word cult is actually considered a pejorative term for NRMs, or new religious movements, which is how we group religious groups and spiritual communities that were formed from the 1800s until now. And of course, aspects of what's broadly viewed as cult-like behavior are observable in totalitarian states. Extreme nationalism, perhaps putting a country's flag on literally everything all the fucking time, and treating its founders like godmen in powdered wigs and not businessmen with stolen teeth. Just Mirlu, a psychoanalyst and doctor of medicine, studied what he called menticide in totalitarian states. Mirlou authored a book called The Rape of the Mind in 1956, and he posited that fear and continual pressure can induce what he deemed a state of menticidal hypnosis. Mirlou points to the House Un-American Activities Committee as an example of attempted thought policing, and he warns of government attempts to coerce public opinion. Good thing we dodged that bullet, eh, Doc? Like I said on Monday, most brainwashing is just conditioning, usually through torture. That's mostly what MKUltra was, by the way. Torture. Sidney Gottlieb founded MKUltra in 1953. Gottlieb was a chemist who specialized in poisons and neurotoxins and innovating new ways to administer them. He was also in charge of designing technology for spy equipment. Everyone's familiar with MKUltra's experimentation with LSD, but that was only part of the project. Unlocking the secret to mind control after intercepting a planted letter from Stalin, suggesting that Soviets had figured out mind control already, was the overall goal, as well as testing the thresholds of human physical and psychological endurances. Carryover from research procured from the Japanese Unit 731 project. The CIA wanted a truth serum, probably most of all. The ability to bypass free will with an injection and know everything about a hostage within minutes. LSD was invented in Basel, Switzerland in 1943, and Gottlieb is credited by many with bringing it to the United States after he arranged for the CIA to buy the world's supply of acid and transport it here for $240,000. He then had it distributed all over the country to be administered to people who had no idea that they were about to do drugs to see if mind control worked. Ken Kesey was a willing participant in a CIA experiment. He wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, partly inspired by a job that he took in a hospital to steal LSD test samples. Allen Ginsberg, Robert Hunter, Timothy Leary, all of them got hepped to LSD through the CIA. It almost calls the entire hippie subculture into question as a giant crypto psyop, doesn't it? Articles in magazines promoting psychedelic drug use were often paid for by Gottlieb and the CIA to encourage people to experiment with hallucinogens, all for government observation. Whitey Bulger agreed to a program alleged to cure schizophrenia while he was in prison. The project was actually an MKUltra front that gave Bulger doses of LSD every day for a year to test the long-term effects of regular LSD use on the human mind. And, you know, he seems to have ended up okay. The point of the application of LSD in the experiments by Gottlieb was to use high doses of hallucinogen to effectively destroy the self, uncreate the personhood of an individual so that a new identity could be imprinted on the subject. This idea originated with the Nazis, who experimented on POWs with mescaline during the war at Dachau, and Nazi doctors were commissioned to give lectures on sarin gas and other neurotoxins to CIA officers at Fort Detrick. To put this into perspective, a Jewish CIA scientist smuggled Nazis onto a military base to teach him how long it takes to poison someone with gas. And ironically, everything about MKUltra violated the Nuremberg Codes, as Gottlieb received almost no informed consent from anyone, including the POWs that they experimented on in Korea. See, after that debacle that we've discussed a few times, where American POWs were shown admitting to war crimes, the government determined that U.S. soldiers were too soft and easily broken by torture or interrogation techniques. And so, one of the side quests of the MKUltra program was torturing POWs to see how long it took to break them in various ways, and trying to develop methods to increase human endurance levels. And by all indications, nobody in an authoritative position wanted to know what Gottlieb was doing, so long as he got results, which he didn't. For the most part, anyway. He figured out how to destroy the human mind, he just never learned how to put it back together after he broke it. And so funding was eventually pulled after nearly $100 million was spent on dosing unsuspecting Americans to see what they'd do. In the meantime, Gottlieb was tapped for assassination attempts on Patrice Lumumba, Zhu Enlai, and Fidel Castro, at one point suggesting a spray can full of LSD to poison Castro during a radio appearance, in addition to the much more famous poison pen attempt that I don't think we ever actually tried, but was in fact developed. It's probably relevant that Gottlieb attested that he'd dosed himself over 200 times. So, his own mind state is questionable, as is the fact that he worked unsupervised for a decade with $90 million in federal funding and whatever narcotics he asked for, next to a collection of former Nazis and CIA ghouls like George Hunter White, who ran Operation Midnight Climax that we discussed back in the Charles Manson episode, wherein the CIA funded a whole bunch of brothels in New England and California so that they could dose Johns to see what would happen if you were tripping while you fucked. Yeah, I guess that's something the government really needed to know. Why, we'll never know, because the results were never released to anybody, and none of the Johns who were experimented on were ever notified that they'd been experimented on. They just went about their merry way thinking they had a really strange experience that afternoon. And so, underneath this now almost 80-year-old fear that communists can trick you into communism is CIA propaganda, CIA operatives, a CIA mind control program, and some church therapists hired by the military to legitimize claims that leftists are able to brainwash your children into communism and queerness using ancient Chinese magic. And a government that convinced itself of its own bullshit to the tune of $90 million and the deaths of an undisclosed number of Americans, including Frank Olson, who either jumped or was thrown out of a window after being unwittingly dosed at work and threatening to go to the press. Olson worked for the CIA at Fort Detrick on aerosol toxins and lots of other James Bondy type weirdness, like a poison lipstick that kills you when you put it on, or a poisoned aerosol that's used by people who have asthma that gives you pneumonia. It's fucking terrifying that someone not only conceived of that but figured out a way to make it work. He'd been dosed by colleagues with LSD and became extremely paranoid and agitated, which I think is hilarious as a description for his behavior, because as a person who's willingly taken LSD dozens and dozens of times, I'm pretty sure that if I started feeling like I was tripping and I didn't know I had taken anything, I would become extremely agitated and paranoid. Especially if I thought perhaps I couldn't trust the people in the room with me because one of them had slipped me drugs. Anyway, those experimented on by MKUltra were listed in their files as expendables, in case you weren't sure how the CIA views the American public. But not just the American public, actually. The CIA had safe houses in Germany, Japan, Austria, and elsewhere that permitted experimentation the likes of which can't be conducted on American soil, which should tell you something considering what they're willing to do here. Olson's death alerted the public to MKUltra's existence, and the Washington Post broke the story in June of 1975, at which point we're told experimentation stopped. The government gave the Olson family $750,000 as a settlement to not sue and drag the matter out into the public further. And as for cults, nowadays groups like Nexium and the Dayspring cult follow the CIA's example just like those who embraced acid culture in the 60s. In some ways, the CIA's attempts to control all of our minds inadvertently shaped how we think. And an idea founded in Orientalism 73 years ago has spawned entire fields of pseudoscientific study dedicated to figuring out a thing that the CIA made up to explain why people are communists. And the idea that religions not endorsed by mainstream culture must have tricked or hypnotized their followers dates back to the Enlightenment. Mormons were actually genocided in Missouri. It was legal to kill Mormons in Missouri from 1838 until 1976 because Mormons had been accused of bewitching converts. The Nazis were accused of mass hypnosis in Germany, and every communist country ever has been alleged of brainwashing millions of people to not prefer capitalism. So, what does all this mean? Because we can look at groups and say, well, these people clearly must have been influenced by something. Why would anyone do that? But that's kind of the point. Brainwashing is just a term we use to explain why people behave in ways that don't make sense to us more often than not. And most of the time, groups of people, and listen, as I am saying this, I want you to understand it's something I have a lot of difficulty with myself, because I look at people who are into QAnon and think there has to be something wrong with your brain and the way you process information for you to be taking this seriously. But the reality is, we are just hardwired to believe people who don't think like us have something wrong with them. And that's a button that the government pushed with propaganda aimed at anybody who doesn't think the way we think here has something fundamentally wrong with them for almost a century, and now all of us believe it. But the fact is, people did not join the People's Temple because Jim Jones used secret Chinese mind control techniques to convince them that communism was a good idea. People didn't start hanging out with Charles Manson because he hypnotized them with LSD and whatever was in his disgusting never-washed pants. Some people are just into shit that doesn't make sense to us, and that is what it is. There doesn't have to be some sort of a clandestine psychological manipulation Jedi mind trick technique involved to explain why a college girl decided she wanted to hang out with a 33-year-old guy who looks like Charles Manson. Sometimes that just happens. Just like Jim Jones. Sometimes that just happens. You can't explain it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that people's minds aren't working correctly. In many ways, I feel like that robs people of agency in these conversations to suggest that, well, that person wasn't capable of making their own decisions. They were placed into a circumstance where someone put their own personhood inside of them and made their decisions for them. And that's not to say that manipulation isn't real. I mean, we talked about how a lot of the things related to CIA mind manipulation techniques, cult psychology, and all of that, it's very much related to pimp shit. and psychology using things like love bombing and forced isolation and milieu control. And there are ways to condition people to react certain ways in certain situations. Conditioning is very much real. Brainwashing is horseshit developed by the CIA. Just like Stockholm Syndrome is horseshit created by the FBI. None of these things are real. They're just to try to explain to you why people in the public space act outside of public perception and expectation. That's all that is. And that's all I've got today. It's a short episode because I didn't really have as much to cover, really. They don't all have to be 90 minutes. Fuck. So I guess I don't know. That's the show. What do you want from me? Fuck. if you liked that, you know, sometimes I wonder, like, I look at the analytics and there's usually a stark drop off after an hour anyway, right? Like, it picks back up again, but I noticed that a lot of people listen for an hour and then wait to finish the show anyway. So perhaps in making the show roughly an hour long, that'll mitigate some of the people who don't listen for longer than an hour in the first sitting anyway. If you liked the show and you would like to become a member of the Hep cult, now that we've discussed that cults aren't a real thing and you have nothing to be afraid of, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. And for as little as $5 a month, you can contribute to my ability to feed myself and keep the lights on here. All subscribers receive a link to the Uncle Bill mixtape, which if you've been following this season, you've heard a few songs from. There's some exclusive content coming that I'm still in the process of getting compiled because I still can't really see out of one of my eyes, but that's forthcoming. As I mentioned at the top of the show, which I actually recorded yesterday, the t-shirts were shipped out yesterday afternoon, so those should be arriving by the end of the week for most of you who live in the United States. For everyone who lives in a freer country with a more nationalized and properly run postal service, it may take a bit longer for things to get through customs, but everyone who ordered should have their tracking numbers in their email. If it's not in your main email, check your spam folder. Those will be up for the foreseeable future, and I'm, like I said, still working on a second design for those shirts. I didn't even mention where you could get the fucking shirts, did I? If you would like to wear and or drink your support for the Come and See podcast, see, this is why I don't record when I don't have weed. You can do so by going to comeandseemerch.bigcartel.com, where you can pick up a bag of Black Forge Coffee Company collaboration with the Come and See podcast, Behold a Dark Roast. It's delicious, it's free trade, and we ship Black Forge Coffee Company, so I recommend going over there and grabbing a bag of that. And now, the thing that I said about the t-shirts makes more sense, because that's also where the t-shirts are. Unless you ordered one, in which case they're in the mail. So that'll be happening soon. Shout out one more time, Luke Hamburski. The design looks fantastic. The logo looks super clean, even though it's entirely illegible, like the way I want it anyway. And I think that's all the clerical things that I have, eh? Yeah, I think so. All right, well, we'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. I'm gonna take the rest of the week to get myself sorted out in terms of getting medicated and things of that nature, and take care of some other things that need to be done in my world. But I will be back on Monday, and on the next episode of Come and See, we are going to discuss Freemasonry, something that people have been asking me to cover since the first season of the show. I think that it intersects enough with enough things. And also, it'll probably take a bit more than a few days to get all of that together, so it's good that I'm not planning on doing a Friday episode this week, because I can take more time to read. But, that we'll be coming back to the storytelling log to talk about Freemasonry, hopefully on Monday. But until then, Concentrate on the HEP, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See. And I will catch all of you HEPcats on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair bust, but I do say no more than 10 to 20 million killed, top, depending on the break. Am I to understand the Russian ambassador is to be admitted to entrance to the war room? You see everything. You see the big board.
I'm finished.